Morning, everyone. You're so quiet out there. It's a little eerie up here. Welcome to this Citizens Board meeting of Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on Tuesday, August 26th. I'd like to welcome board members, all the staff of the agency, members of other agencies, and the citizens and parties who have matters before the board today to this meeting. And those of you watching on the webcast, welcome to the meeting as well. I'd like to call this meeting to order. First of all, board members, I'd like to ask for a review of the agenda and adoption of the agenda. If that's agreeable, entertain a motion. Motion and second to approve the agenda. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. Agenda is adopted. Thank you. For the minutes of our previous meeting, July 22nd, we had a copy of those distributed in the packet, board members. You might recall that Mr. Ibarra and Ms. Hang participated by phone. First time that's happened in a very, I don't know that it's ever happened before, but
long time.
Long time. Dr. Foley can correct me on that. It's been a long time. And there's... Any corrections or additions to the minutes of the July 22nd meeting? If not, I'll ask for a motion for approval.
So
motion by Mr. Riddle. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Foley. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. Thank you. Moving on to the agenda, let's go to the legal report from Ms. Olson from the Attorney General's office.
Thank you, Chair. Board members, there's two items I wanted to update you on. One is Reichman Land and Cattle. I've updated you previously on that, but this is to let you know that the MPC asked the Supreme Court to grant review, and the review was granted. This case concerned the MPCA's effort to address pollution generated by a cattle feedlot that operates seasonally in the winter. The Court of Appeals decided that this operation did require a state permit, but overturned MPCA's decision that a federal NPDES permit was required. So that's what's going up on appeal. We're going to start briefing that, and it will be a period of time before we get a decision on that, but we'll let you know when the hearing's going to be or the oral argument, and then also when the decision comes out. And on another matter, there was a recent positive Court of Appeals decision. It involved waste management, and it concerned whether MPCA's decision to require permitted landfills to comply with a statute that prohibits acceptance of unprocessed waste generated in the metro area was valid without rulemaking. The Court of Appeals affirmed that MPCA was free to enforce the statute by putting terms requiring compliance into permits without first going through rulemaking. If you'd like a copy of that decision, too, we can certainly get you a copy of that. I have no other items. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Board members, just having a matter of the agency go before the state Supreme Court is a big deal. So it doesn't happen all that frequently, and we will be interested to see how that decision plays out. Let's move on. Thank you for the legal report. For the commissioner's report, I have a number of items I wanted to update the board on. And I will let you know that the Environmental Quality Board has released a report on climate change, describing it's entitled Minnesota and Climate Change, Our Tomorrow Starts Today. The report, there are very few hard copies. They're encouraging us all to look at the report online. It is on the EQB's website, and we'll get that information to you so that you can easily access the website. Primarily, the purpose of the report is to go quickly through the categories of climate change and its effects on Minnesota, as well as some opportunities that the state has to address those impacts through better planning and resilience in our communities, and also looking toward how we can reduce overall contributions to climate, greenhouse gas, and other drivers. So it's an interesting report. It's very friendly, and members of the public, if you have not seen this report and would like to access it. It's on the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board's website, and I highly recommend it. Secondly, the governor has been traveling in part throughout Minnesota to hold some community conversations on rail safety, and I've attended two of those so far. One, he's had three meetings, one in Little Canada, one in Alexandria, and one in Red Wing. And we're going to have additional meetings across the state. The point of the meetings is to listen to community first responders, especially police, fire, and local emergency management personnel, as well as traffic concerns and other interests from the community. As you know, the primary driver of some of the rail challenges in the state has been the increased flow of oil from North Dakota because of the production of the Bakken Formation. And that oil production is increasing traffic on our rails dramatically. There are a number of safety concerns and issues associated with that, as well as discussion of environmental concerns. So I'm there representing the PCA, also represented at those meetings as the Department of Transportation, and then the Department of Public Safety. So there's been good turnout and good discussion. It's the governor's hope is that it will inform policy decisions and funding requests that might be needed in the future in the legislature. Along with that, I wanted to talk about the input that the agency has been providing to the Public Utilities Commission on the proposed pipeline that Enbridge Pipeline Company has been under review at the Public Utilities Commission. There's one alignment that's been titled the Sandpiper proposed pipeline. It goes from northwestern Minnesota and terminates in Superior, Wisconsin. A number of alignment options have been discussed and debated, and the agency has put forward recommendations to the Public Utilities Commission on opening up additional options for alignment review. This is one where the Public Utilities Commission makes the decision on route and on the need for the pipeline. So we have submitted a number of documents. The Public Utilities Commission has a very formal document management system that we access, and we will forward to you the means to access all their materials on their docket, so that if you want to review any of the information on any of these projects, you won't just have what the PCA has submitted. You'll have all. We'll help you get access so you can look at all the documents related to the PUC's decision-making process. Our staff have been putting in a lot of work on that for environmental review and alternative route selection purposes. The fourth item on my list is we just Friday issued a letter on a silica sand transloading facility in Winona. It's called, name of the company is CD. The city had issued a permit, conditional use permit, was going to modify their conditional use permit to allow the company to change its operation from their previous throughput, retaining the same annual volume of throughput, but allowing them to modify how they distribute their throughput of sand to basically be flexible according to the navigation season on the river and other priorities for the company. We reviewed that and determined that it was subject to our environmental review requirements for a mandatory EAW. And because it met the definition of a project and it exceeded the threshold in the statute of 200,000 cubic yards per year of or 200,000 tons, excuse me, of sand per year. So we've sent the letter to the Winona CD to this company and notified the community and a number of You might see that showing up in the media interviews, especially wanted to mention it for Mr. Riddle because it's in your community. Fifth item, we had the peer review for the wild rice and sulfate water quality standard week before last here in the Twin Cities. The peer review is a process that takes several months to complete. It's reviewing the scientific information and some charge questions that the agency's staff developed to try to evaluate the strength of the data and the statistical analysis methods that the agency used to define, to consider defining a water quality standard for wild rice. The peer review was held in public. There were a number of people who attended. It was widely covered in the media, and wanted to just congratulate Shannon Lotthammer and the Environmental Analysis and Outcome Divisions and her team for their good work on that. The report from the peer reviewers answering the charge questions is due back in the end of September. Once we have that information and we're ready to talk about what it means to the agency, which will be sometime after September 30th, we'll bring that matter back to the board for review and discussion so you can benefit from hearing what was discussed there. Next, I wanted to talk about the letter that I sent to the EPA Region 5 Office of the Administrator on Mesabi Nugget and the variance that the board granted in December of 2012, which allowed Mesabi Nugget to discharge water that did not strictly conform to water quality requirements for some winter months from their mine pit. We granted the variance and conditioned the approval of that variance on some very specific parameters as a settlement for litigation. The EPA and the Department of Justice rescinded their approval of our variance. I challenged that in a letter back to the regional administrator, and we're working with the EPA right now in reviewing their decision, my letter, and all the facts associated with this variance. So I'll keep you posted as that unfolds, but we're not at a stage of resolution yet, but there are ongoing discussions that are at least proceeding. Lastly, if you have not yet been to the Great Minnesota Get-Together, the State Fair, I encourage everyone who is going to the fair to visit the Eco Experience Building. It's an exhibit up on the north end of Old Machinery Hill, just north of the 4-H building. It's a fantastic display. We've been there for a number of years with a great set of partners who display information about the environment, about choices that we make as citizens to live in an environmentally sustainable way. There's always a new display. I'm looking at the folks from the health department in their drinking water display. Love the little water tower. And the groundwater display that you guys have there is always fantastic. There's transport and transit displays at the building, giving people information about how they can make better and wiser transportation choices. There is a feature this year where we're trying to have the world's largest wad of paper. If you haven't seen it, it's a large paper ball that's hanging from a, or maybe it's set on a, but it sits up off the ground. It's hanging or sitting on a pedestal. And it represents the amount of paper that's thrown away in the state every 30 seconds. And it's a significant volume of paper that's wasted because that's a recoverable material that could be used to generate new products and new materials. So we do all these displays, and then I'd like to give credit, lastly, to the Department of Commerce for their energy efficiency and energy conservation displays, always in the center of our building where you can learn about a variety of energy conservation, again, which is making wise use of our fuels and our heating sources, but also reducing our impact on the climate of Minnesota. And so there's some really wonderful displays, and I encourage everyone to stop by the building if you haven't done so, and identify yourself at the information desk if you're a board member, and I'm sure they'll be happy to show you around, give you a little, answer any questions you have. That's the end of my report. Any questions from board members for me? Thank you. Let's move on to items by board members. Mr. Riddle.
Thank you. I have two items. First, I'd just like to thank you and the MPCA for your decision on the need for mandatory EAW for the CD Corporation's change in their silica sand processing operation. I don't live in town. I'm about 12 miles south of town, but I continue to hear a lot of concerns about the need for more robust air quality monitoring in the city of Winona, especially locating any monitors near the property lines of the sand processing and loading facilities, and that's not happening yet. So there's definitely a need for more data to be gathered on the impact. So, but appreciate taking that position. Became aware of a new U.S. Geological Survey research that's looked at levels of neonicotinoids in rivers. And they analyzed 9 rivers in the upper Midwest, including in Minnesota, and are finding neonicotinoids in every one of the rivers that they're testing. And neonicotinoids have been implicated in the loss of native pollinators and honeybees and have actually been banned in several European countries now. And when we looked at the water quality standards recently for rivers, I didn't see levels one way or another for neonicotinoids. And there's certainly the potential for causing harm to aquatic insect larvae, you know, things like dragonflies, damselflies, mayflies, but also pollinators, butterflies that drink water as well. So I think it's an issue to pay attention to. We really hadn't heard about the levels in water bodies before, but when USGS looked at it, they're finding them in all the rivers they're testing. So those are my items.
Thank you, Mr. Riddle, and we'll pass that message along to our Environmental Analysis and Outcomes team, Shannon Lotthammer's group, and look forward to seeing that paper. Other items from board members. Mr. Ybarra.
Commissioner, in your report, you referenced the agency's involvement in the PC or PUC dealings with the Sandpiper Bridge, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I want to make sure that this agency and these board members know that the folks that I represent have a staked interest in a lot of opportunities for work, and I was compelled to provide testimony before the PUC, so I want to make sure, fully disclose that in the event that that project comes before this body, that I have taken a position publicly on that and look forward to having a discussion with agency counsel as to whether or not I participate in those discussions that come before this body or whether I should recuse myself. So I just want to make sure that that was on the record.
Appreciate that, Mr. Ybarra. Thank you. And Mr. Ybarra, in that spirit, you're representing pipe fitters and other trades?
Correct.
Thank you. Other items from board members? Seeing none, we'll close that item on the agenda. I wanted to just, before we move into the rest of our agenda this morning, looking at the day and the number of folks I know who are here to be heard on matters before the board today. Board members, just want to give you a heads up. We're probably going to make it partway through our agenda and break for lunch and come back after lunch today. So if you have any plans that would conflict with that, please let us know as soon as possible, because we're going to be here for some time into the afternoon, if not all day. So just want to give you a heads up on that. And then let's move on to our information item. This item is, and Mr. Johnson and Mr. Neeprash are here from the League of Minnesota Cities and the Minnesota City Stormwater Coalition. You might recall last month at our meeting, board members, we talked about the MS4 permit update and provided the board with a little bit of a status report. I think it was Dr. Drager said it'd be interesting to hear what the community's think about this. We were tight on the agenda that day. We did not provide an opportunity for the cities to be heard, and today we invited them here to provide their perspective. So welcome to the board, and Mr. Johnson, I'll let you kick it off.
Thank you, Commissioner, members of the board. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Very much appreciate taking a couple minutes on a very busy agenda to sneak this in while the matter is still fresh in members' minds. I would like to start by just clarifying from items that we heard at the last board meeting that some comments were made about how contentious and almost obstructionist that some parties were in the last permit. We would not agree with that characterization. We were the main parties involved, the League of Cities and the Minnesota City Stormwater Coalition. And in every case, we worked very successfully with very good staff. The staff worked very hard with us. And we always had opportunities to work out compromises, and there were always solutions on the table. There was never just blatant attempts to stop for the sake of stopping. There was always an end result of wanting a good permit that worked. And so very much appreciate the chance to come in and, one, clarify that, and, two, really pass along to you our perspective on how it's going, which I think Randy will cover in detail, but it's pretty consistent with what you heard from staff, just from our perspective. And then I just want to personally thank the staff and the commissioner's office, both prior to this permit being developed and implemented, and since the permit was adopted by the board and implemented, have had nothing but success and a very, very open door policy of working with us when we find challenges or difficulties, when issues have come up legislatively related to stormwater, when we hear other agencies starting to do things that affect stormwater. These folks jump in and make sure that that agency understands that we have a permit that cities already deal with, and it's under control, don't worry. With that, thank you very much. I'll be available if folks have questions for me at the end of this, and I'll let Mr. Nepresh give the details of our feedback.
Thanks, Mr. Johnson. Welcome, Mr. Nepresh. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Commissioner Stein, members of the board. My name's Randy Nepresh. I'm the staff for the Minnesota Cities Stormwater Coalition. We are, as we were the last time we spoke, about 130 cities that are regulated under the MS4 general permit. I'll reiterate Craig's comment. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. Last month, the stormwater section staff spoke about the application process under the new MS4 general permit. And they described it in very positive terms, and we wish to concur with that characterization this morning in multiple ways. The application process was timely, relatively smooth for all the cities, and that was in large part because of the good work of the PCA staff. Greatly appreciated. At the beginning of the process and the development of the permit, we were told that the application process would be as simple and straightforward as possible. And in our view, the staff and the agency delivered on that commitment. When questions came up during the process, the staff was consistently reasonable and flexible. The reports from all our members were that the questions raised were always in a constructive manner. The staff was consistently helpful and provided assistance when it was needed. There were also workshops that were put together by the staff during the application process, and those were both well attended and well executed, greatly appreciated by the permittees. The staff has prepared useful guidance materials for this application process. And those, again, were widely used by all the permittees. There are additional workshops that are scheduled for this coming fall and into next year. We appreciate the fact that those were done in collaboration with the Minnesota Erosion Control Association and a member of our city's coalition steering committee. That's a nice collaborative approach to see during a process like this. The Stormwater Manual continues to be a remarkable technical resource. There are new revisions to that manual during the last year or so, and those have been well done and on important topics, again, widely used by the permittees. We've received consistently positive reports from our members regarding the program audits that have been conducted by the staff. In a manner similar to the application process, the questions posed by the staff and the requests for information have been consistently been reasonable, and the staff has been helpful and constructive during the audits as well. We are now in the process of developing our own guidance materials to help our member cities through the compliance process. We've started some of that, submitted those materials to the staff, and they've been giving us very timely review and response to those materials. We also appreciate the commitment on the part of the staff to continue to do that as we move forward. Finally, the staff went out of their way at the last presentation, the last meeting, to make very positive comments about the high quality of the submittal materials from the permittees. Not surprisingly, we are in complete agreement with that statement. That's always appreciated. We've got to be clear about these things. We also appreciated the lively discussion on the MS4 issues among the board members at last month's meeting. And I wanted very briefly to address some of the issues that came up. Board member Dr. Drager, you had brought up some concerns regarding the estimated cost of compliance. At this point, we are still early in the process. We've made it through the application process, but we're only in the middle of working out how we're going to comply with the new provisions of the permit. Most of those provisions, compliance is due either 12 months after the extension of permit coverage or at the time of the submittal of annual reports. So our expectation is that within the next, say, 8 to 12 months, we'll have a much better handle as to the actual cost that we expect for compliance. We would be happy to come back to the board at that time with that information. Board member Dr. Sampson brought up some questions regarding the stormwater manual. It continues to have a remarkable number of hits on the website. That's been the case ever since it was written, many years ago now. We believe that that number of hits is a measure of the manual's usefulness, but also of the desire of stormwater professionals, design engineers, all sorts of folks working in this field, to access meaningful technical information. One of our consistent messages to the board has always been that these new stormwater regulations have very real and significant impacts on very broad worlds of public works and private development throughout the state. And we believe that the use of the manual is a good indicator as to the breadth and scope of those impacts. Finally, there was a good bit of discussion about using the MS4 program audits as a way to gather more information about stormwater systems throughout the state. We advise against using that approach. Audits are very specific, targeted tasks. They're very much focused on compliance, and they're based after everybody gathers all the requested information. They're complex, intense, short-term meetings that are based on a remarkable body of information. And they really aren't an appropriate venue to seek general information. Among other things, the folks that are being audited are rather tense during an audit process. So casual conversation doesn't work real well. Our suggestion instead is that the PCA staff talk with our coalition. Send us the questions. Have informal conversations. We created the coalition, and it is structured to facilitate conversation and communication between a large number of regulated parties and a complex state agency. So our very simple recommendation is please encourage the staff to talk to us more. It's nice and simple. And with that, my comments are done, and thank you for the chance of presenting them to you.
Thank you, Mr. Neprash. Any questions from board members? Dr. Drager, you look like you have one.
Just one. You referenced the high quality of the submittal materials. I was struck when we had the original presentation. I believe there was someone from Little Canada who was concerned about her map-making abilities, and staff said we would even accept, like, a hand-drawn map. Have you found that to be the case? Has that been submitted? Has that been accepted? I just want to follow up on both the capacity of the submitters and then the acceptance of those materials by the staff.
Yes.
Mr. Neprash.
Thank you. We have heard no reports of any problems with that. And it is the case. The capacities of individual cities, and this goes right to the township level. So the capacities vary enormously And our experience so far has been that the staff has been very flexible and is willing to accept what permittees are able to assemble. Thank you.
And Mr. Neprash, just one other thought in response to your last comment about the value of using audit data and audit information in terms of informing the future of the program. I just go back to my health department days and talk about epidemiologists and what they learn in the investigations often is aggregated at a different scale, at a different level of detail that can be useful to diagnosing concerns later. So while I understand your concern about the detail of an audit and using that level of information for sort of decision-making or vetting new questions or ideas, I would also ask the folks involved on the community side to think about once we leave the audit process, consider the audit data when you contribute ideas, because what we're going to find is we're going to see themes. And so if we can work together on that, I think that might be a really helpful way for us to think about not necessarily going down into the minutiae of the audit findings. I agree that that could be problematic for a community. But certainly what we learn might be of value to both parties. So just a comment from my chair. Thank you for your time this morning. Appreciate your presence and your contribution to the review of our efforts. Thank you. Let's move on to our decision items. And for our first one, I'm going to call forward Kathy Sather and Sandy Berman, who've got some updates for our site listings for the State Superfund. And members of the audience, just while we're transitioning, if you're here to speak on any one of the agenda topics today and you want to be heard by the board, there are some green slips of paper near the entrance. They look like this. Please fill one out. Bring it to Karen Holmes, our board secretary, and we'll make sure that we give everyone an opportunity to be heard. Just by way of sort of organizational requirements, we may have to limit time of speakers so that we don't get run out of time for everyone to be heard on a subject. So just please submit that, and we'll take your request and give everyone a chance. Now, for this matter, I'm going to turn it to Ms. Sather. Welcome to the board. Please introduce yourselves and the subject.
Thank you, Commissioner and members of the board. My name is Kathy Sather. I'm the director of the Remediation Division at MPCA. And we were last here in February presenting to the board and provided an overview of the Superfund program, and at that time requested and received your approval to add 8 new sites and remove 1 site from our State Superfund permanent list of priorities. We are back again today to request your approval to add another 2 sites to that listing and to provide context to that conversation, to the discussion, and then also for the benefit of our audience, we will provide you with a brief refresher of the Superfund program and the process to help in your decision making. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Sandeep Berman, and he's the manager of the Site Remediation and Redevelopment Section in the Remediation Division.
Thank you. Welcome to the board. Mr. Berman, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the board, good morning. My name is Sandeep Berman. I'm the section manager for the Site Remediation and Redevelopment Section in the Remediation Division.
Please proceed with your presentation, Mr. Berman.
Thank you, Commissioner Stein. Thank you, members of the board, for this opportunity to appear before you today with a proposal for update of the State Superfund list. The project team that has worked on these 2 sites that we are proposing to list on the State Superfund list before you today, besides Director Sather and myself, we have Doug Beckwith, supervisor in the Superfund program, Rick Jolly, hydrogeologist, Dave Moore and Eric Pedersen, project managers, and Craig Bigelow, who is the program coordinator for the Superfund program. We thought it would be of value, perhaps, to the board to provide you with a brief overview of the history of the Superfund program. This dates back to 1980, the passage of the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, commonly known as CERCLA. This is the federal Superfund program that gave the federal government the authority to respond to hazardous substance releases, established the federal Superfund program administered by the U.S. EPA, and it set up the what is referred to as the National Priorities List, or the commonly known as the Federal Superfund List. On the state side, in 1983, we saw the passage of the Minnesota Environmental Response Liability Act, commonly referred to as MERLA, or the State Superfund Law, which gave the state broad authority to respond to hazardous substance releases, complementing the federal law. It set up the State Superfund Program, administered by the MPCA and the State Department of Agriculture, and it also created the State Superfund List, more formally known as the Permanent List of Priorities. Again, we thought it would be some value to the board to establish a brief overview of the Superfund process itself. Superfund process typically begins with the assessment phase. This follows the initial discovery of contamination, and the objective of the assessment phase is to really gain an idea of the severity of the release, to determine if additional work is necessary, and to identify responsible parties. The assessment phase, if deemed necessary by the assessment phase, we move on to the investigation phase, the objective wherein is to define the full extent and magnitude of the contamination. The investigation phase results in the cleanup phase, where the actual physical process of the cleanup is completed. And the final phase is site completion, site closure, sometimes referred to as well, where all standards, environmental health and public health have been met. Looking at the history of the Superfund program, we see that a total of 443 sites have gone through the State Superfund program, of which 273 have been completed. 170 sites are still active in the State Superfund program. Looking closer at the 170 sites that are currently active, 89 of the sites, the work has been conducted by responsible parties, but with MPCA oversight. The remaining 81 sites are on the State Superfund list currently. These 81 sites consist of a mixture of sites, roughly half, where responsible parties have been identified post-listing, have been engaged, and are conducting the work under the authorities of the State Superfund program with MPCA oversight. The remaining approximately half of these 81 sites, there are no viable responsible parties, so the MPCA is doing the work using State Superfund funding. We get an idea here of the distribution of Superfund sites across the state, both closed and open. As you can see, there's unmistakably a cluster in the metro area, not surprisingly, but you do see a fairly uniform distribution across the state, coinciding very well with centers of population and industry. And that holds true for closed sites as well as the open sites and what we're seeing of new releases being reported to the MPC of hazardous substances. This slide attempts to give you an idea of trends historically of how Superfund sites have been discovered and have come to the attention of the MPCA and have entered the Superfund program. As you can see, the first year that sites were listed were 1984, following the passage of the State Superfund Law in 83. This graph is not to scale for purposes of simplicity. We condensed that first graph just so we could get that large number in there. But we had a large number of sites immediately placed on the list in the very first year of 93 sites. Since then, 254 sites have been added. You can kind of see how the trend was tailing off, and we reached a period of stability and consistency in the middle years. The last couple of years, we have seen an upward spike, and as Director Sather mentioned, we were here earlier this year. We are proposing to list about half a dozen sites. We're back here with two more. And we anticipate 2015 we'll see somewhere in the vicinity of 6 to 8 sites that we would propose just based on what's going through our site assessment program currently. Of the 254 sites added to the State Superfund list, 46 sites have also been added to the National Priorities List or the Federal Superfund list, which is essentially a subset of the State Superfund list. Likewise, looking at expenditures of State Superfund funding, barring some anomalous years which correspond into specialized funding that was mandated by the legislature on specific projects, some on the North Shore and a few here in the metro, you again see a recent upward tick in the last few years, again corresponding to the increase of sites coming into the program. The fiscal year 14 number is still evolving. The fiscal year was just ended on July 30th. We're still going through the closure process. We expect that number to ultimately be close to the $5 million mark. This brings us to our appearance today before the board with a request for an approval of update to the state Superfund list. The update essentially consists of a proposal to add two additional sites to the state Superfund list, which would bring the total up to 83 from the current 81. These two sites are exclusive cleaners in the city of Worthington and the public water supply system, the municipal wells of the city of Spring Park. The update process that we have followed so far has been as required by state statute and state rule. This requires a 30-day notice to be published in the state register, which has been done. No public comments were received during the 30-day period. In addition to that, the MPCA also sends out specific notices to all interested and affected parties that we're aware of, and letting them know of our intent to list the site. The MPCA Public Information Office also does a press release in the surrounding communities. Looking closer at the first site, the site is former exclusive cleaners in the city of Worthington in southwestern Minnesota, located on the intersection of I-90 and Highway 60. The site is it's a former dry cleaner facility, and the environmental impact from the site is a release of the chemical perchloroethylene, commonly referred to as PERC or PCE. This is some of the most commonly used dry cleaning solvents that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It still remains widely used for dry cleaning across the nation, and about half of the dry cleaners in Minnesota still currently use this chemical, even though attempts are underway to phase it out. The risk at this site is essentially high levels of this chemical, perchloroethylene, in soil gas that has been detected at the site and in the surrounding buildings. The site is essentially in a residential commercial area, and the concentrations of perchloroethylene in indoor air in surrounding buildings exceed the Minnesota Department of Health's current standard. This current standard, referred to as the health risk assessment advice issued by the State Department of Health, is 2 micrograms per cubic meter of perchloroethylene. The indoor air concentrations in surrounding buildings have been as high as 53 micrograms per cubic meter, about 25 times higher than the allowable standard. The actual soil gas concentrations in the source area are much higher than that, of orders of magnitude higher than the allowable indoor air standard. As a result of this, the MPCA Site Assessment Program, which is an arm of the Superfund Program, and the Emergency Response Program have already installed 8 vapor mitigation systems in the adjacent buildings as part of our interim short-term response. We get a closer look at the setup around the site. The exclusive cleaner site is outlined in red. It is currently an empty parking lot. The building has been demolished, and the surrounding areas are a mixture of commercial establishments, and moving farther out, we get into some residential areas. The eight buildings that have received the short-term care in terms of having emergency systems installed are outlined. The reasons for listing the site is essentially to allow us to continue the work that has been started in an interim fashion by finishing off the definition of soil, groundwater, and soil gas contamination, to continue the investigation of vapor intrusion into the surrounding buildings, moving outwards from the ones that are immediately affected, to identify responsible parties, and to complete what essentially already appears will have to be a cleanup conducted at the source area, given the high level of contaminants present, which will continue to act as a source for vapor intrusion at the buildings unless we do actual cleanup. Moving on to look at the second site, which is the public water supply system of the city of Spring Park. City of Spring Park is located in western Hennepin County along the western shores of Lake Minnetonka. It is essentially an isthmus of land about 225 acres in size that's bounded by West Arm Bay of Lake Minnetonka to the north and Spring Park Bay of Lake Minnetonka to the south. The city of Orono is to the east, and the city of Mound is to the west. Although the site, the detection of contamination has been at the municipal supply systems, Homeland Security regulations preclude us from displaying the specific locations of the well on public documents. So what we have tried to show you here is the municipal outline of the city of Spring Park. And as we will see, that is relevant to the discussion in hand, because the environmental impact here is to the entire public water supply system. Two of the three municipal wells are impacted by levels of trichloroethylene, or commonly known as TCE, another very pervasive, very common chemical that's has been widely used historically, continues to be widely used in the metal fabrication, metal plating business as a cleaner, as a solvent, and it's also used in a diversity of chemical manufacturing processes. The concentrations of this chemical have been slowly increasing in the public water supply system for the last decade. The contamination source, although several are under investigation, we have not yet definitively identified one single source that can be attributed to this detection of contaminants in the public water supply system. The risk is essentially to all the residents of the city. All of the 1,700 residents are on public water supply system. And as I said, two of the three municipal wells have been impacted. The federal drinking water standard for this chemical, trichloroethylene, is 5 parts per billion. And that is the legal regulatory limit that the city has to comply with as administered by the State Department of Health. However, in 2013, the Minnesota Department of Health, based on new toxicological information, did issue a revised state standard referred to as a health-based value for trichloroethylene that is 0.4 parts per billion. So it's of the order of 10 times lower than the current legally required federal standard. The levels in the city wells have approximately been about 2 parts per billion consistently since 2012. This triggered the Department of Health issuing a health advisory letter to the city in February of 2014, recommending that the 0.4 parts per billion standard be the goal in the interest of public health and to be protective of all consumers of the city water supply. The issuance of the health advisory also triggered MPCA shifting from an investigatory mode, which we were in since the new number was issued in 2013, we shifted gears to more of a immediate remedial action mode for the city water supply to assist the city in getting that down to the new standards. The reasons for listing, similar to the Worthington site but on a much larger scale, are again to define the extent and magnitude of the groundwater contamination. This promises to be a very significant investigation, given we already are seeing multiple aquifers, multiple drinking water aquifers that are not only of local value but are premium regional drinking water aquifers have been impacted. The extent, both aerially and vertically, remains undefined. We are also concerned about potentially impacts to Lake Minnetonka, as well as impacts to surrounding communities of Mound and Orono, who draw from the same aquifers. There is, as I said before, there are also short-term actions that have already begun with help of the Department of Health. The city, MPCA, have come up with a phase plan for getting the municipal water supply back in compliance with the 0.4 part per billion HPV on a very short-term temporary basis while the longer-term cleanup is conducted. The listing on the State Superfund will facilitate that short-term response to continue as well and culminate in the installation of a treatment subsystem for the city water supply, which will ensure that the water meets standards. The listing will also help in what is undoubtedly going to be a prolonged and complicated search for a responsible party, given the multitude of potential sources, and to bring those parties to the table and engage with them so that they fulfill their obligations for cleanup. And finally, a significant long-term cleanup of the impacted aquifers will be needed at this site. Again, State Superfund listing would greatly facilitate that. And I should also mention for the board's benefit that we haven't seen a site of this magnitude for many years. So this is, after a long time, we are actively engaged with the federal government, with the US EPA, to pursue listing of the site on the federal list as well to acquire additional funding and additional resources from EPA. That brings us to the summary of our appearance today before you, requesting approval for this proposed update. To summarize, the MPCA Superfund program is proposing to add two sites to the State Superfund list. The process has complied with state statute and state rule in terms of publishing the notice in the State Register, providing additional information to all affected interested parties, doing additional outreach efforts such as the press release. No comments were formally received in that 30-day period, but the City of Spring Park has reaffirmed its support for this process and has expressed its desire to see this site listed in order to allow all resources to be brought to bear on this serious problem for the city. The process that we have followed so far does comply with all the applicable state statutes and rules. So therefore, in summary, MPCA staff would recommend to the MPCA Citizens Board that the addition of these two sites, the exclusive cleaner site in Worthington and the municipal drinking water supply for City of Spring Park, be added to the state superfund list. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berman. And I have a request from the mayor of Spring Park to be heard, and we'll get to that in due course. Questions, board members, for the staff? Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, I have two questions, one concerning each of these sites. First, in the Worthington site, there's been some short-term mitigation of the Head Start facility for excluding vapors. Has there been air monitoring to determine the effectiveness there of that site?
Mr. Berman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Member Riddle. We are in the process of getting that going. We just issued the contract to do some follow-up indoor air monitoring to ensure the efficacy of these systems.
Okay.
You had a second one, too?
Right. And concerning the Spring Park site, you mentioned that the cities of Mound and Orono draw their water from the same aquifers. Has there been any water testing to look at the levels in their water supplies?
Mr. Berman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Member Riddle. As with all public water supplies, Department of Health conducts routine compliance monitoring, and so far there has not been any concern of any detections in either of those two cities.
Okay, thank you.
And then just for my own edification, and since the health department's here, I'd like to hear from someone from the health department about the change in the standard, the HPV for TCE, and just if Mr. Kelly or someone could comment, sort of talk to the history of that change and sort of remind us of the previous thoughts of the health department on that and sort of, thank you. Mr. Kelly, for coming forward, and just if you would introduce yourself. And then my question is, just summarize the history of the change in the department's recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jim Kelly. I'm the Manager of Environmental Surveillance and Assessment in the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. Briefly, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Health under the Groundwater Protection Act is charged with developing health risk limits for contaminants in groundwater, and we do that on a continual basis. Trichloroethylene is Mr. Berman indicated, is a very common groundwater contaminant that occurs in the groundwater, unfortunately, in the state of Minnesota. And we've been conducting and reviewing information with regards to the toxicity of trichloroethylene, or TCE, for quite some time. That effort culminated in 2013 with, based on primarily on new information from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, a new assessment document on the toxicity of TCE that became available, I think earlier than that, in late 2011 or 2012. Based on our review of that document, we were able to develop new guidance for trichloroethylene in groundwater, as was referenced, a health-based value, which is the first stage of developing a health risk limit for this contaminant in groundwater. And so we completed that process in 2013 and then issued the new health-based value, which was pointed out the lowest. We actually develop a number of guidance values, the lowest of which is 0.4 micrograms of TCE per liter of water. That guidance value was issued at that time in May, I believe May of 2013, and kind of led to the events that bring us here today with regards to Spring Park. But it is the culmination of many years of review of the toxicity of this compound, literally thousands of different studies that were evaluated as a part of the EPA's assessment process and then our review of the toxicity of this particular chemical. We are in the process of promulgating that value through a rulemaking process as a health risk limit. That process is getting underway now, and we expect it to be completed either later this year or early next year, and that will actually put that value into rule. the MPCA typically uses these values as cleanup goals in evaluating sites such as this particular site in Spring Park.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. I'd like to call Sarah Reinhart, the mayor of Spring Park, forward to just offer comments on this subject. I know she's representing the city today and is offered to provide a few comments for the board. Welcome to the board, Ms. Mayor, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner and board members. My name is Sarah Reinhart. I am the mayor of the city of Spring Park. One of the core functions and responsibilities of a city is to provide safe drinking water for its residents. And so we take this new health-based value very seriously. Despite being under the federal limits for TCE, we understand the science behind this new health-based value and would like to comply. And we welcome the opportunity to be placed on this state Superfund list to enable us to provide that safe drinking water for our residents. Just to put in a little perspective, some city demographics, you know, we are a small city with 1,700 residents. 25% of those live in Presbyterian Homes nursing home and is a more vulnerable population to water contaminants. We also in Hennepin County are the city that has the highest percentage. 30% of our residents are age 65 and over, also kind of contributing to that vulnerable population. And lastly, our population makeup of housing units, 70% come from medium and high density residential apartments, very transient population. So it's difficult to continue to get information out about drinking water when the population is so kind of volatile and moving. So we, again, are very appreciative of the Department of Health and the MPCA and your board, and really are interested in your approval today. Thank you,
Madam Mayor. Any questions? Appreciate you being here this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So, board members, are there any other comments or questions? If not, we have a staff resolution, which is proposed, and you can find it on page 4 of 4 of the packet where the matter is summarized for us, and look for a motion to put forward that staff resolution or discuss an alternative.
Commissioner, I have one question for for staff.
Thank you, Mr. Ibarra.
My apologies. In your presentation, you referenced 273 closed sites. Has the agency developed a protocol for going back and reviewing these closed sites to make a determination, because they are cleaned up as far as what the standards were at some point in time, to go back and analyze these sites for vapor intrusion contamination?
Mr. Berman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ibarra. We are in the process of doing some modeling to determine which of these sites need to be looked at on a priority basis for vapor intrusion. The 273 closed sites in the Superfund program, we also have other sites that have gone through the other hazardous substance cleanup program, the Brownfin program, the RECRA program, all of which in totality give us a larger number than the 273 to look at. So we're in the process of prioritizing, and we hope to shortly actually do some field work even as early as this fall to go back and look at the ones we think merit the most serious consideration.
Thank you. One more question in regards to the Spring Park site. Are there measurements being taken in terms of what the actual contamination is in the lake, and that potentially could have an impact on fish consumption out of fish caught out of Lake Minnetonka?
Mr. Berman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Member Ibarra. That would be part of the expanded investigation phase that would follow the listing. Right now, we've been focused essentially on the drinking water supply.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner.
Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, I have a question, and it relates more to the policy. I was going to ask it after we took the vote, but we're voting, the board is voting to add the sites to the list. What action is required to remove the site from the list? Does that require a board action also? Or is that a administration determination?
Yeah. Mr. Berman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Member Jensen. the listing and delisting of sites, which is essentially the removal, the delisting being the removal, are both considered updates of the list. And as such, state statute and state rule do require that both of these processes come before the MPCA board for approval. And we have brought forth a delisting, I believe, earlier February of this year. I think one of the sites on the list was a delisting site that accompanied maybe my memory is failing me. It might have been the board meeting in fall of 2013, but in at least in the recent 6 months or so, we have come before the board with a request to delist the site. I believe it was the Bassett Creek Irving Avenue site in Minneapolis that the board approved delisting, and I apologize, I can't recall which specific meeting it was at. But absolutely, listings and delistings both are required by statute and rule to be brought before the board.
Thank you. Other questions from board members? Mr. Riddle.
Concerning the language of the suggested staff resolution, it just references these two sites by attachment three without actually naming them in the resolution. And I'm just wondering if we should actually name them, their location, in the resolution before we put it forward, rather than just by reference to an attachment three.
Ms. Olson, advice.
Chair, board members, you can certainly make an amendment to the suggested staff resolution to name the sites. You do have the attachment as part of the board packet and what was published as well, so that would be sufficient. But if the board would feel more comfortable, that would certainly be something you could do.
So, Mr. Riddle, if you're amenable and we offer the motion, you could insert the names of the sites after the at a point in the second clause, be it further resolved, hereby adopts the addition of two MPCA proposed sites. You could name them right there, perhaps.
Will do.
Thank you. Other questions from board members? Seeing none, Ms. Olson would like to augment her comments. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair, board members. I just wanted to direct you to the state register and the official notice. If you are thinking of adding some language, you might want to follow the language as is there, where it indicates just if you go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 7 paragraph.
What page?
It's page 1688 of the official notice. So if you go to after the conclusions of law, the Minnesota State Register, and there would be the 1, 2, the fifth page on the top. It should be called official notices.
Yep.
And if you go down 6 paragraphs, it says the MPCA is proposing to add the following two sites, and then it defines them as exclusive cleaners, Worthington, Nobles County, and Spring Park Municipal Wells, Hennepin County. You could add that and say as described in attachment 3.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Mr. Riddle.
Well, I would move that we adopt the staff recommendation with one amendment or one change to the language, and that is by inserting the words exclusive cleaners, Worthington, Nobles County, and Spring Park Municipal Wells, Hennepin County, to the second paragraph after the words two MPCA proposed sites, comma.
Thank you, Mr. Riddle. Is there a second for that motion?
I second.
Second by Dr. Drager. Board members, do you fully understand what we did? Looks like I see everyone's head nodding. It's good practice for us. And if any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we will call the roll. Find my book. On the motion as amended, Mr. Ibarra.
Aye.
Dr. Sampson is absent. Dr. Drager.
Aye.
Dr. Foley.
Aye.
Ms. Hang is absent. Mr. Jensen.
Aye.
Mr. Riddle.
Aye.
And the chair votes aye. The motion passes. Thank you to staff. Thanks to Mayor Reinhart for your presence this morning. All right, board members, let's move on to our second agenda item this morning for decision, which is the Riverview LLP Baker Dairy, their request for approval of findings of fact, conclusion of law and order, and authorization to issue a negative declaration on the need for an environmental impact statement. And I just want to remind anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard, please fill out a green slip of paper found by the door, the entrance door to the room, and if you want to be heard, fill out the form, bring it to the board secretary, Ms. Holmes, seated at to my left, and she'll make sure that we get your name in the queue. Speaking before us today, I have Mr. Peterson, Mr. Schwint. I'll turn it over to you to make a presentation, and just for the sake of the order of our presentations today, we will begin with our staff presentation, then we'll hear from the citizens and the public who've come forward, and then we'll ask if the company wants to make any remarks, if the company has representatives here, and then we'll wrap up with the staff summary after that before a decision is made by the board. Good morning, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Schwint, please introduce yourselves and begin your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Charles Peterson, and I am the project manager for the environmental assessment worksheet that was prepared on the proposed Baker Dairy near, located near Chicago.
Chicago.
I knew I was going to mess that up. Sitting next to me is George Schwint. Mr. Schwint is an engineer in the feedlot program and reviewed the feedlot permit application. The purpose of this presentation is to brief the board on the decision on whether an environmental impact statement is warranted for the proposed project. The proposed project was reviewed by MPCA and DNR staff, and the key contacts for permit areas are listed above. Riverview LLP Baker Dairy is a proposal to construct a new 9,200 animal unit Jersey dairy. The permit application for coverage of the proposed project under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, State Disposal System, NPDES-SDS General Feedlot Permit was submitted to the MPCA. The General Feedlot Permit is a zero discharge permit. Neighbors were notified of the new dairy by notice placed in the Morris Sun Tribune. Coverage under the general feedlot permit was also public noticed. Minnesota rules state that the construction of an animal feedlot facility with a capacity of 1,000 animal units must complete an environmental assessment worksheet and designates the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as a responsible government unit. The proposed project is in Stevens County in west central Minnesota, about 5 miles south of the city of Chicago. The facility will be built in Section 36 of Baker Township and will be located in the Pomme de Terre River watershed, which is a tributary to the Minnesota River. A majority of the land application acres are located in the Pomme de Terre River watershed. Some of the land application acres are also located in the Mistinka River watershed, which is a tributary to the Bois de Sioux River. Here is the site plan of the proposed dairy. The cows will be housed in a cross-ventilated barn. Manure will be collected at least twice a day and dumped into a day pit. Manure from the day pit is run through a solid separator. Solids are stored on the stacking pad and then reused as bedding in the barn. The liquid portion of the manure is pumped to the straw-covered basin. Runoff from the feed pad will be collected in a runoff basin, then pumped to the straw-covered basin. Liquid from the straw-covered basin drains into the two liquid-covered manure basins. The two liquid manure basins will have impermeable covers. Clean stormwater from the site will be collected and stored in an earthen stormwater basin with a controlled outlet to a county tile line. An environmental assessment worksheet, or EAW, is a standard list of questions to screen projects that may have the potential for significant environmental effects. The EAW is subject to a 30-day public review period before the responsible government unit makes a decision about whether a project also needs an environmental impact statement or an EIS. A draft EAW was received from the Riverview LLP. MPCA staff reviewed the draft EAW and worked with the project proposer to ensure that the information in the EAW was complete and accurate. Notice of the availability of the EAW was published in the Environmental Quality Board's EQB Monitor on May 26. The EAW was made available for review on the MPCA webpage. A news release was provided to the media statewide. The proposer held an informational meeting for the public at the Chicago Alberta High School on July 22nd. 24 comment letters were received on time, 6 comment letters from government agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, the Historical Society, Stevens County Environmental Services, Baker Township, Stevens Township, Sinis Township, and 18 letters were received from citizens. There were 15 requests for the preparation of an environmental impact statement. A number of concerns were brought up in the comment letters. The main concerns are groundwater supply, odor, and manure management. Other concerns mentioned in the comment letters included damage to roads and damage to wetlands. Additionally, several socioeconomic concerns were raised in the comment letters and include competition from large dairies is driving small farmers out of business, making it difficult or impossible for young farmers to get started, recruitment of workers in Mexico, high prices paid for cropland is driving up property taxes, and a large dairy will have a negative impact on the quality of life for nearby residents. While these are important socioeconomic issues, they are outside the scope of an EAW. Comments on groundwater centered mainly on concerns about nearby wells will go dry. Riverview currently operates several similar Jersey dairies. Total water use at these dairies averages 29 gallons per cow per day. At this rate, the proposed Baker Dairy would use about 99 million gallons per year. Baker Dairy changed their source of water during the review period, and a pipeline to deliver water to Baker Dairy will cross a number of roads and wetlands. Here's a map which shows the location of Baker Dairy, West River Dairy, the well, and the pipeline route. A well was constructed at the Baker Dairy site with DNR approval. The quality of the water from that well was not as good as desired for dairy cows. The proposer then applied to construct a new well at their existing West River Dairy. The DNR gave approval but had concerns about the long-term sustainability of the aquifer. As the EAW process moved forward, the proposer continued to pursue alternative sources of water. An existing fully permitted well was located that was to supply water for an ethanol plant that has not been constructed. The proposer decided to pursue this source of water for the dairy. The DNR granted approval to use a portion of the permitted appropriation, up to 226 million gallons per year. MPCA staff determined the change in the water source was not a substantial change in the project. The water is from an ethanol plant which had previously completed environmental review. During the environmental review of the ethanol plant, concerns about the water supply were identified and permit conditions were included in the water appropriation permit to address those concerns. The permit was amended to include Baker Dairy. The total amount of water appropriated from the well was not increased and no permit conditions were changed. The proposer will pipe water from the well to the proposed dairy. The pipeline will be installed over a distance of approximately 12 miles. The pipe will cross multiple township and county roads, and the project will cross one unnamed stream and cross or pass close by two wetlands. Directional bores will be used to go underneath these wetlands and roads and stream to avoid impacting them. A number of comment letters raise concerns about the odor the proposed dairy will generate. EAWs for animal feedlots include air modeling for hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, and odor. The modeling looked at predicted hourly concentrations at the property line, 8 nearby residences, 2 proposed on-site apartment buildings, and 1 on-site residence. The highest modeled value at nearby at a nearby residence was below the faint odor threshold. The maximum predicted odor at 5 of the 8 sites modeled was below the very faint threshold. As part of the NPDES SDS permit, feedlot operators are required to submit an approved odor management plan. The odor management plan becomes an enforceable part of the facility's permit. Baker Dairy will implement the following odor control measures: an impermeable synthetic cover over the earthen basins, a biofilter to filter air from the day pit, storing mortalities in an enclosed shed, covering feed to prevent rotting, cleaning up spilled feed promptly, injecting liquid manure during application season, frequently cleaning the freestall barns, using a manure separator, which eliminates the need to agitate the manure during pumping. The proposed area must also follow Minnesota rules for land application of manure. This includes applying manure at agronomic rates, annually testing manure nutrient content, and soil testing cropland for phosphorus. A manure management plan is a required submittal with a feedlot permit application and is an enforceable part of the general feedlot permit. For transferred manure, the producer is required to submit an annual report to the MPCA on manure production, land application, and any discharges. Manure application sites are currently in crop production, and nutrients from manure will be used to replace other nutrient sources such as commercial fertilizers. MPCA and/or county setbacks, whichever are more restrictive, must be observed around drain tile intakes located within or adjacent to manure application areas and near other surface water resources. To apply manure at proper agronomic rates, approximately 6,300 acres of land are needed per year. The proposed dairy currently operates 3,060 acres that are available for manure application. The additional manure will be sold to neighboring farmers. Here is a map of land application acres that will be operated by Baker Dairy. Additional acres will be needed in area farm fields that are not owned, rented, or leased by the proposer. More than 14,000 acres of additional farmland are available within a 4-mile radius of the site that could receive manure. The proposer plans to sell the remaining manure to area farmers. Liquid manure as a fertilizer is attractive to farmers because manure is significantly discounted versus commercial fertilizer and performs just as well. As an example, using the 2013 manure price, 1,000 acres worth of manure would save over $100,000 in fertilizer costs. I'm now going to talk about the legal standard and criteria for a decision on the need for an environmental impact statement. Minnesota rule establishes a standard for the decision on the need for an environmental impact statement. An environmental impact statement shall be ordered for projects that have the potential for significant environmental effects. Minnesota rule provides further direction to the RGUs, providing the following decision criteria that must be considered when applying the standard to whether or not an EIS shall be ordered: type, extent, and reversibility of environmental effects, cumulative potential effects, ongoing public regulatory authority, and the extent to which environmental effects can be anticipated and controlled as a result of available environmental studies. MPCA staff finds that the project, as it is proposed, does not have the potential for significant environmental effects based on the type, extent, and reversibility of impacts that are reasonably expected to occur from the project. We looked at air quality and found modeled air concentrations demonstrated compliance with state standards and were below the health-based and nuisance odor criteria. The surrounding area is currently in agricultural production. Primary access to the project is by a paved road, and the project area will be either paved or grass. We looked at water quality and found the operation and management of the feedlot and the MMP can be modified, and impacts to water could be reversed. Measures to prevent or mitigate these impacts have been developed and are required as permit conditions. We looked at water quantity and found mitigation measures were incorporated into the water appropriation permit requirements, and observation well monitoring conditions were included for verification. When considering potential cumulative effects, the RGU must consider these four factors: whether the cumulative potential effect is significant, whether the contribution from the project is significant when viewed in connection with other contributions to the cumulative potential effect, the degree to which the project complies with approved mitigation measures specifically designed to address the cumulative potential effect, and the efforts of the project proposer to minimize the contributions from the project. MPCA staff find that the project is not expected to result in significant adverse cumulative potential effects. When we considered air quality, we found the modeling analysis included the estimated emissions from the proposed project and incorporated conservative background concentrations. There are no other feedlots in the air modeling domain. Modeled air concentrations demonstrated compliance with state standards and were below the health base and nuisance odor criteria. When we considered water quality, we found the proposed dairy must follow Minnesota rules for manure storage design and land application. Manure application sites related to Baker Dairy are currently in crop production. Nutrients from the manure will be used to replace other nutrient sources such as commercial fertilizers. When we considered water quantity, we found the individual DNR water appropriation permit is required for the project. The DNR has a standard well interference and water conflict process as established under Minnesota rule. MPCA staff find that the environmental effects of the project are subject to mitigation by ongoing public regulatory authority. The following permits or approvals will be required for the project: the MPCA general feedlot permit and construction stormwater permit. That incorporates construction and operational requirements that include a manure management plan, an operation and maintenance plan, an emergency response protocols, an animal mortality plan, an odor and air quality management, and a stormwater pollution prevention plan. They are also required to have an individual DNR water appropriation permit, a Stevens County conditional use permit and building permit, and Clean Water Act Section 404 and Section 401 permits. In addition to the data presented in the EAW, the permit application and required plans and submittals, the air dispersion modeling report, MPCA staff took into consideration information from previous feedlot EAWs and environmental impact statements, and the Pomme de Terre River TMDL. Please refer to page 5 of the board item for the staff recommendation and suggested resolution. The MPCA staff recommends that, in accordance with the standard and criteria set forth in Minnesota rules, the board approve the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order, which conclude that the proposed project does not have the potential for significant environmental effects, authorize the commissioner to publish a negative declaration indicating that the proposed project will not require an EIS, and adopt the following staff resolution. Be it resolved that, in accordance with the standard and criteria set forth in Minnesota rules, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency approves and adopts the attached findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order, which conclude that the Riverview LLP Baker Dairy project proposed by Riverview LLP and analyzed in the environmental assessment worksheet does not have the potential for significant environmental effects. The commissioner is authorized to execute the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order on behalf of the MPCA. Be it further resolved that the MPCA authorizes the commissioner on behalf of the MPCA to publish a negative declaration on the need for an environmental impact statement. This concludes the staff presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Board members, questions? Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, Mr. Peterson, you referenced the source of the water, which seems to be an important element of the application, at 226 million gallons a year, I believe. But coming from the proposed site of an ethanol plant, what's the status of that project?
At this point, Mr. Chair, Board Member Jensen, at this time, to my knowledge, there is no plans to build that ethanol plant. There's nothing existing on the site. They still have the permit. They've kept the permit active, so one would assume that they intend at some point in time in the future to build that plant.
Commissioner, Mr. Peterson, what conflict would that present then with the dairy?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Board Member Jensen, if that plant were to go forward, the dairy and the ethanol plant would have to work out conditions as to who would get how much water from the wells. There's actually two wells on that permit. Baker Dairy would only be taken from one of the two wells, but the permit still only authorizes a total withdraw 452 million gallons per year, which is what was originally authorized for the ethanol plant. The two combined cannot exceed that amount.
Thank you.
Dr. Foley.
Well, just as a corollary to that, how long does the permitted but not built ethanol plant get to hold the right to extract that amount of water by the DNR?
Mr. Chairman,
it's like we
Commissioner
have
Foley,
DNR.
I'd like to ask the DNR to come forward and answer that question.
Certainly. See, Mr. Frischman has arrived.
I recognize that face.
Yep. Good morning.
Welcome to the board. Mr. Frischman, please introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Jay Frischman. I work for the Department of Natural Resources. I supervise the Groundwater Technical Analysis Unit, who provide technical support for permitting, the appropriation permits. Chairman Stein, Dr. Foley, could you ask that question again so that I can formulate a better answer for you?
It just seems like the DNR has granted the proposed ethanol plant 452 million gallon draw out of their well, which they're going to now split with this dairy operation. How long does a not built but proposed operation get to hold the right to extract that kind of water and shift it around relative to others who might want to use that water?
Mr. Frischman.
The answer to that is actually this is a rather unique situation. As you're aware, in the late 2000s, we had a number of ethanol plants come forward. Some were built, some were not. Part of the EAW process for all of those was to look at water supply issues. In this case, the permit was granted for what they thought they were going to need. Obviously, they didn't build a plant, as has been conveyed earlier. As far as how long you can maintain a permit, as long as you pay you have to report your usage, in this case, zero, and then you have to pay, a minimum fee to maintain the permit. We actually have permits on the record dating back to the late 70s when appropriations statute came into play that some folks drilled wells and some actually have never pumped. But because of the individual understandings, namely the thought that it's a water right, they will maintain those permits by reporting zero usage, and then paying that fee. This is a unique scenario in that the permit is still being maintained by this company. I assumed it was strictly with the idea they were going to build an ethanol plant at some point. But the fact is that at this point they haven't. They now are my understanding is that Baker Dairy is now also a sub-party to the permit. And, if they use $226 million and the ethanol plant moves forward, then we would do a completely new analysis with either they're going to have to balance their water usage or we would end up doing a review at 456 plus 226, whatever that comes out to be, and then we would look at that overall appropriation and the effects of that.
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Foley.
Yeah, I remember our discussions before on ethanol and running these kind of drawdown tests and what time of the year you did them. And remember, we went all through that before. it just seems to me that the ability to just hold the right to draw all this water may affect other people's ability to propose some other use for that water, and they're kind of stymied because someone who came before them now has an unused water allocation but holds the right to do it. So then as we look at that hierarchy of water use, it just seems to be not a very good use of the potential for that water. I do understand that they want to take 226 million gallons of it now where it will get used. So they can hold this right to draw that amount of water in perpetuity as long as they just pay a fee?
Mr. Freshman.
Commissioner Stein, Dr. Foley. Actually, it's not a right that they're holding. They just happen to have a permit with, you know, that rate and volume on it. They aren't guaranteed in the future that they will have any of that water. If, in fact, we see, if they had, say they had appropriated at 5 million gallons, and we had seen a negative effect on the Pomonotier River, which is the source that this groundwater is connected to, you know, we very easily could have said no appropriation. So this isn't a first-in-time, first-in-right scenario. It just so happens that they had developed this source, and, you know, I can't address Baker Dairy's thought process on this other than they looked around. Well, they had initially applied for on-site wells. We identified some issues with that. They, you know, looked around, and there were these wells sitting there. Now, whether the permit had been active or not, we still would have looked at these as a possible source, or they would have, and then we would have looked at it, you know, on a permitting side. Anybody coming in has the same right to that water. Obviously, we've discussed the priority system in the past, but just because they have a permit does not guarantee them a right to that water in perpetuity.
And Mr. Frischman, maybe I could just ask a couple of questions. First of all, the owner of the wells, in order to maintain an active permit, it's correct, I believe, that they would have to maintain ownership of the property and of the well itself and of all the infrastructure. So for the ethanol facility that was never developed, the owner of the property is still the same. Property owner has to prove that they are, in fact, the owner to maintain that permit. Is that accurate?
Commissioner Stein, I believe that is correct.
And secondly, I was curious, and maybe you can amplify, or if not, I'll ask the company's representatives to do this if they're here and can answer this. The relationship between Baker Dairy and the owner of the ethanol facility, how they came to agreement, is there a contractual arrangement? Is it some kind of an agreement between parties, or is it I just would like to know, you said in the permit there was some kind of a change relationship on the who's permitted to use the water. Is that, maybe I misheard you, but if you could clarify that.
Commissioner Stein, that's correct. That's my understanding, is that they are now listed as an authorized agent under the permit, but I defer to the company to actually describe that relationship.
Thank you. Mr. Ibarra.
Just along the same lines as Dr. Foley, so as long as the owner continues to keep the permit active, there's no time frame in which they have to construct or operate. I would assume that's what the permit is for, construction and operation of an ethanol plant. So there's no time frame, so long as they continue to keep that permit active, that they have to actually construct and operate an ethanol plant?
Mr. Frischman.
Commissioner Stein, Representative Ibarra. The two, I believe they're disconnected. The construction of the plant, really, that falls probably more under county construction rules, that sort of thing. The water appropriation permit goes with the wells and the appropriation itself. Now, if the use changes, you do need to make a permit amendment, and that was part of what would have played out here. But from the standpoint of is it tied to a construction? No, sir.
Dr. Foley.
So as an expert in how these wells and drawdowns, having managed many of these well tests in the past, based upon that experience, do you believe that now accessing 226 million gallons a year and shipping it to this dairy will affect either the river, any of the, will there be any hydrogeological shift of that amount, knowing full well that you approved 400 some out of the same area, that nobody else's use of water will be affected by this drawdown?
Mr. Frischman.
Commissioner Stein, Dr. Foley. The initial work that was done was actually done by a different hydrogeologist than myself. It was one of the ethanol plants I did not actually actively work on. But they did conduct an aquifer test, and the permit was issued with several conditions. Number one, as has been mentioned, there's the monitoring conditions on observation wells. The second is that they recognized the connection to the pomme de terre based upon the aquifer test. And unfortunately, I don't recall what that pumping rate was, but usually it was geared towards that total appropriation that was permitted. At the time, they did decide, came to the conclusion there was a connection. This permit does have a unique condition on it in recognition of that connection to the pomme de terre. The appropriation is tied to flows at the stream gauge at Appleton, which is downstream of here. So based upon, and I have a copy of the permit here, but there are several different pumping scenarios that are laid out based upon flow in the stream. So at flow X, you can pump, say, the north well and up to a certain rate. That changes both the rate and volume based upon those flows. That helps address the concerns for potential low flow impacts. So the answer, in short, yes, we recognize at the time that there was a connection to the pomme de terre. And you know, the fact is they're asking for about a fourth of that. The actual numbers that are being discussed here is flows greater from than 31 cubic foot per second down to equal to or less than 15 CFS, and the actual appropriations are graded based upon that and drop down to, it looks like zero here on one of the well fields, and it decreases dramatically on the other. The other part of the question is what kind of impacts to neighboring users. If we are talking a domestic well interference, that sort of situation, as has been mentioned, we do have a process for dealing with that. We routinely deal with well interferences every year, and based upon a priority system, a domestic well owner needs to be made whole before the appropriator can take the water that they're asking for. If it is a irrigator who's at the same priority level, then we get into a water use conflict scenario where then we have to start balancing out the use. At this time, I don't anticipate any specific well interferences or water use conflicts based upon this. That was considered during the appropriation process earlier, and those conditions are in the permit. Okay.
Mr. Frischman, a few technical questions because I have to. Are the observation wells installed?
Commissioner Stein, yes, the observation wells were installed. It's my understanding they were used during the aquifer testing. Unfortunately, it does not appear that they were monitored for the last 5 years. So if nothing else, we've missed the opportunity to have 5 years of background data.
Thank you. The second question is the gauge that's referenced in the permit continuously monitored, or what's the nature of that stream flow gauge? Is it one that's supported by the Department of Natural Resources, by the USGS, or who's actually responsible for that gauge?
Commissioner Stein, I'm going to just go off of the permit condition. It references the USGS river gauge at Appleton Station number XXX shall be monitored daily. So I'm going to, based upon that, assume that it is a continuous
gauge. Thank you. Dr. Drager, did you have a question? Okay. Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, back for Mr. Peterson.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Frischman or for the Department of Natural Resources at this time?
Commissioner.
Mr. Jensen. Check your mic, Mr. Jensen. I think you missed the button. There you go.
There you go.
All right. On now?
There you are.
Okay. Question relates to the point in the one of the issues in the requested for contested hearing was the crossing of, I believe, wetlands and so forth. Is this pipeline already constructed or is that proposed to be constructed? Because it appeared that it went across a an actually open body of water.
Mr. Frischman.
Commissioner Stein, Representative Jensen, I do not know. That was not that would not be addressed by my technical group.
Thanks. Well, I think Mr. Peterson will know the answer to that question. Any further questions? Mr. Frischman, thank you for being here, but I'd also ask you to stick around in case we have additional questions that come up after public comments. Thank you.
Certainly, sir.
So Mr. Jensen's question repeated to you, Mr. Peterson, is what's the nature of the pipeline? Has it been constructed or not?
Chairman Stein, Board Member Jensen, no, the pipeline has not been constructed at this time. They have contracted with an engineering firm, and they have engineering plans to put the pipeline in place.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Peterson? Mr. Ibarra.
Mine's probably an easy one. In the issue statement, you reference the facility housing 8,850 Jersey cows, 500 Jersey heifers for a maximum physical capacity of 9,200 animal units. Now, my simple math tells me that's 9,350. Are heifers counted as a half an animal unit or something along those lines?
Mr. Peterson.
Chairman Stein, Board Member Ibarra, heifers are counted as 0.7 animal units, and that's how we come up to 9,200 animal units.
Thank you.
Dr. Drager.
Yes, so there have been some extreme rainfall events, and I think as we look forward, having more extreme weather events is being built into different climate models. How did you take those into consideration as you were modeling?
Mr. Peterson.
Chairman Stein, Commissioner or Board Member Drager, modeling in terms of what?
Oh, I was thinking like in terms of the lagoon storage or okay. Any of the other items, even land application of manure. I mean, we just had a 7-inch rainfall event within the last 2 weeks or so. So I think it hasn't been unusual for that this summer. So just wondering how these extreme rainfall events are taken into consideration, especially as you do your forward forecasting and modeling.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Drager, George, would you like to respond to that?
Mr. Schwint, please introduce yourself for the board and respond to the question. Thank you.
Mr. Commissioner, my name is George Schwint. I'm a field engineer for the MPCA. I reviewed the permit application and the plans and specs for the lagoons. The lagoons are designed to contain all the runoff from a 25-year, 24-hour storm. That's the universal engineering standard that's always used, and roughly it equates to about 5 inches of rainfall in that particular area. That's what they're designed for. To design it for a 100-year storm, we don't require that level of design. It's the 25-year, 24-hour storm.
Mr. Schwinn, if you could clarify, we don't require that's a standard. It's a rule or a requirement or a standard that we apply in terms of feedlot and dairy design requirements. Would that be correct?
It's not in our rule that they have to design for the 25-year, 24-hour storm. There is a statute that says we cannot take any action above the 25-year, 24-hour storm. So runoff after that point is basically exempt. It just goes. So that statute is out there. And they also have the NPDES permit, which once they get to the 25-year, 24-hour storm volume, those regulations no longer apply, and then it's seen as, I don't know, an act of God type of situation.
Excessive. No, thank you. Yeah. Dr. Drager.
So, you know, having just listened to Dr. Mark Seeley, the extension climatologist for state of Minnesota, we're seeing, he's shown the hydrographs that we're having an increasing number of these events. We've had a number of those, what you would call act of God events already this summer that exceed the 5-inch in 24-hour mark. So how is our modeling keeping up with these changes? How is that standard? How is that regulation? I mean, we're in keeping up.
Mr. Schwint, and then I can speak more broadly about the agency's other program requirements. But Mr. Schwint.
Mr. Commissioner, Board Member Drager. The data for the 25-year 24-hour storm was just recently updated. It was updated, I believe, about a year ago. So that number has gone up. It was 4.8, now it's 5.2 or 3. I'm not sure exactly what the number is, but it's gone up in response to some of these more extreme events. So that number has been changing. As far as modeling goes, we don't do modeling for runoff from the facility. We don't.
Just and Dr. Drager, I'll comment too that relative to the hydrologic requirements that all agencies utilize, the Mr. Schwint's referring to the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's recently published document that adjusts the hydrologic information about rainfall and runoff for the whole nation. It was last updated prior to that update in 2012 or 2013. The last update was 1960 or 61. It has shown in the upper Midwest a dramatic increase in the total amount of rainfall for a given frequency of storm events. So expressed in percentages, like a 1% chance storm is like a 100-year event, a 0.2% chance storm is a 500-year event. It's just a term of statistics. But those volumes of rainfall throughout the Midwest and across Minnesota have increased. And the agency is looking at that for how we should adjust our rules for all kinds of water permits. Because our rules and the standards that we adopt for stormwater runoff, for wastewater treatment and discharge, all hinge on that data, those data sets, and we need to factor that into our planning for the future. So it's a complicated problem, but it is real, and the data prove that there is a what we once thought was an XYZ size storm is different now. Dr. Foley.
Well, George, could you explain, do you expect a protective effect from the cover over these manure storage pits relative to what my colleague talked about, these acts of God storms? Does the cover provide a protection that should not allow for the kind of runoff?
Mr. Schwint.
Mr. Chair and Member Foley, the covers will help in the event that we get so much rainfall that runoff will be going over the top of a basin. That will prevent interaction between runoff from surrounding lands and the basin manure itself. I don't expect that situation. That's a lot of water to be in that one particular spot. I mean, we're talking the basins are built above ground, so you got like 6-foot berms. So it'd be the entire land covered with 6 feet of water. But as far as the cover goes, it will prevent water from going into the basin that falls directly on top of the cover. The cover has a runoff collection system, so that water is then removed from the system, not into the basin. So the basin is designed for 14 months of storage. So there is some extra bounce built in there. The feed pad runoff that comes from the site, that's all collected and put in that same storage structure. So that will impact a greater rainfall in the feed storage area. We'll put more waste in the basin, but the waste that falls directly on that basin would be excluded from storage. So there is some extra bounce room in there.
So, Mr. Chairman, so there's estimated 63 million gallons of manure produced a year out of the animal units that are proposed. What's the overall storage capacity? What's that 14-month storage capacity relative to the production?
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein, Member Foley, I don't have the exact number in front of me. I can't tell you exactly what those basins are going to hold. I can look that information up and present that back to you. I don't know that off the top of my head. the overall storage volume.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just going along the lines of you're saying that there's 3,060 acres that the proposer owns to apply a portion of the 63 million gallons produced a year. How feasible is it that the remaining amount of land necessary for the application that they will be able to contract for that, and in the surrounding area, because it says they own 8 dairies already, do we have any double counting on land that is either owned or contracted that is already being counted for the other 7 dairies?
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein, Member Foley, I would suggest you ask the project proposers that question. I mean, they do operate the other dairies. They have successfully done the model where you transfer some of your manure to your neighbors, and they can speak on their relations with their neighbors and access to that land. As far as double counting acres goes, I don't believe there's any overlap between the existing dairies permits and this permit.
Okay.
And Dr. Foley, I just would make a point that we do have representatives of
they're going to present, right?
Baker Dairy here, and they'll be able to stand for questions and clarification. Thank you. Mr. Peterson or Mr. Schwint, I had on your presentation, you had the comment on the slide of the facility that there was a clean stormwater. It seemed a little I might want to put the word clean in quotations there, just from a standpoint of understanding what's meant by that. So if you could just more slowly describe the process of the manure and the how runoff from the site is actually directed throughout the property, that might be. I just would like to have that more slowly describe for me. Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein, the clean stormwater basin, let's start there, and what material would be going into that clean stormwater basin. That would be runoff from lawns, grasslands, the roof structure from the barn itself, typical municipal stormwater type of runoff. Any water that would fall on the haylage or silage pad that's pictured there to the south, that goes into the feed pad runoff basin, which is a short-term structure where the runoff goes into, solids are settled out in a concrete structure so they can remove the solids. Net runoff then goes into the liquid basins to the north on this picture.
And so there was, Mr. Peterson described a solid separator. Where is that on the site? Is it the separation building? Is that what I...
Yeah, Commissioner Stein, yes, it would be housed in the separation building.
So that's primarily those solids then are used for bedding in the milking parlor, or what's the point of those solid? Just explain that for me again, please.
Okay. They'll take the solids out. They'll separate the solids out of the manure, basically dry them out, and then it'll be used back as bedding actually in the freestyle barn. It would not be used in the parlor itself. Generally, they get excess, and they either have to land apply the excess amount of solids or sell it to other entities.
Thank you. Mr. Riddle.
Thank you. I have a number of questions. First, I guess I'll start with the West River Dairy. That's operated by the same proposer, correct? Riverview?
Sir Peterson?
Chairman Stein, Board Member Riddle, correct.
Okay. How many animal units are maintained there? Do you know?
Mr. Peterson.
Commissioner Stein, Member Riddle, again, I don't have the exact number, but it is a substantial amount. I would
substantial amount.
Say 8,000, okay. 9,000. Somewhere in that range.
All right. And according to your map, it looks like about a mile and a half away from the proposed new facility.
Mr. Peterson.
Or less, I guess.
No. Chairman Stein, Commissioner, Board Member Riddle, no, it's actually about 6 miles.
Oh, okay. I didn't know the divisions there. Okay, so about 6 miles.
Yeah, each one of those sections is about a mile in width.
All right. And it was my understanding from the comments that there are a number of feedlots in the area. Some hog feedlots are mentioned as being located near the proposed site. I don't know. I guess I'd just like you to explain your statement on page 3, number 13. It says there are no other neighboring feedlots in the same area. And 6 miles, to me, is still the same area. How do you define area here?
Mr. Peterson.
Chairman Stein, Board Member Riddle. In that statement, I was referring to the air modeling domain. The air modeling domain typically extends one section beyond the proposed feedlot. So we look at the section that the proposed feedlot is in and then the 8 surrounding sections. And so with reference to that, it's roughly a mile and a half surrounding that proposed dairy.
Okay, so none of these hog facilities that are mentioned by commenters are within that mile and a half radius?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, and I do have a question about the air modeling. In point 14 on, about hydrogen sulfide, your modeling shows 29.24 parts per billion, with the standard being 30 parts per billion. So it's pushing the limit based on modeling already there. I mean, it's right up to the line. Do you have actual monitoring results from the border of the West River Dairy or one of the other facilities, not just modeling, but actual hydrogen sulfide data?
Mr. Peterson.
Chairman Stein, Board Member Riddle, I'm looking at George. I know that we've monitored a number of sites, but I don't believe that we've monitored any of the Riverview Dairy sites.
That'd be helpful. Yeah, and then I have questions about the whole land application of the manure on page 2. You say that the manure will be applied at nitrogen-based agronomic rates. And I may be wrong, but it's my understanding that we also have to take phosphorus into account in agronomic rates. And I don't see any analysis here of the phosphorus-based agronomic rates and how much land would be required when you base application on phosphorus rather than nitrogen.
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein, Member Riddle. Our rules require them to base their application rate on nitrogen, considering phosphorus. The phosphorus is considered when the levels of the fields, the soil test phosphorus, reach certain thresholds. And those, I'm just going to try and get them at the top of my head, I want to say are 60 parts per million in Olson and 75 Bray. So that's the level where the phosphorus regulations would kick in. And even at that point, they can still apply manure. It just needs to be at a rate that phosphorus is removed over the crop rotation, over a 6-year rotation. So phosphorus is considered, but it's not a phosphorus-based rate plan.
Okay. But it has to be considered.
It's considered.
And have you considered it in this analysis of how much land is needed given the soil types and the phosphorus levels in that region?
Mr. Schwinn.
Commissioner Stein, Member Riddle. The fields in this area could use more phosphorus. They can use the phosphorus. The transferred ownership manure, the portion that's transferred to neighbors, that is not regulated by the permit. That land is regulated by the rule. So whoever is running that land, the cropland manager for that land, applies at agronomic rates. That's his responsibility. The land that's kept underneath their control, the 3,000 acres, would be regulated by the permit and that phosphorus restriction. So each year they report to us what they did as far as land application goes of rates, how much they applied, and we look at the soil test phosphorus. And they're required to test their field phosphorus every 4 years. So those rates are tracked and monitored.
Well, page 8 talks about some watershed, the existing impairments in areas that would be impacted by this facility, and saying that Little Muddy Creek watershed is impaired already for phosphorus and eutrophication. And then Drywood Creek has other impairments too. I won't go through all those. They're in the data. And the wraps have not been completed. So it seems to me that we don't have the data, the wraps haven't been completed, and this analysis hasn't really looked at the phosphorus impacts, and especially when you've got over half the manure is planned to be sold and then become somebody else's responsibility, essentially. So it's outside of this permit, even. It seems very problematic and something that should be addressed much deeper level than has been done here.
Dr. Drager, did you have another comment or question? No. Okay. Other questions for our staff? Board members, what I'll propose then is that we take a short break while we prepare for the public testimony. And just members of the public that I've got your registration forms, I'm gonna give you the sort of the lineup of folks and the way I'd like you to present. If you would sort of think about this and prepare as you're, and I'll remind you as we go how we'll be taking your testimony, so you won't have to remember this. But first up will be John Kleindl of Stevens Township and himself, then Nathan Burmeister, followed by Kathy DeBoer, Don Pilkinen, followed by looks like some Andersons, Keith Anderson, Lila Anderson, Debbie Anderson, and last, Jody DeCamp. And so there are, that's what we'll do when we return, is take you in order. What my goal would be is to attempt to limit your comments, if you could, to 5 or 6 minutes. That would help us get through everyone in time to have some follow-up discussion, perhaps before lunch. But as I said, we'll take the time necessary to make sure everything is heard. So with that, board members, let's take a 5-minute recess.